Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 87 of Dominaria's Judgment, a weekly Constructed Magic podcast brought to you by me, Dom Harvey, along with Ari Lax. And this week, we are teaching all of you out there how to be the scammer and not the scammy. We are going back into these deck-specific deep dives. Haven't done one of these in a bit, and this is a deck which I think both of us have a pretty strong interest in at this point. So very excited to get into all the ins and outs of Rakdos Scam in Modern here.
Yeah, I am going to be playing this deck this weekend. You played this deck last weekend. I think it's just like generally a very good deck, and it starts looking better when you consider the fact that Izzet Murktide has... I think that one of the stories of Modern right now is that the Izzet Murktide players that are still winning are almost winning despite the fact that they're playing Izzet Murktide. They are like... the best Izzet Murktide players in the room, and they are playing it a ton, and like the deck is still just like not really overperforming despite the people sticking to it being really good players. I there's a lot of issues across the board about why, and some of it is just that people are fed up losing to it and stop playing the decks that lose to it. But yeah, I think that that is one of the big things about Scam that has been an issue in the past. We'll probably talk about that as one of the big topics here, but I think that it is less of an issue now than it's been in a lot of points in the past, and not quite ever, but pretty close.
This is where that whole 2023 Jund criticism comes in, right? Where it feels like Murktide is a fundamentally solid deck, is a good deck, always going to be the most popular deck, or is likely to be at any given Modern tournament, and yet it feels like you have to work a lot harder for the wins with it than you used to. A lot of the matchups, which maybe were slightly favored before and now slightly unfavored, you don't get to this point, coming up on 2 years now, dear God, since Modern Horizons 2, without having at least what you think is a solid plan for your Murktide matchup. And so I think you're seeing that really just get iterated on over and over and over again, to the point where, yeah, if you are a Murktide main, I think you can keep doing that, but it's not going to be this slam dunk choice that it has been at many points in the past.
Yeah, and I think some of it was that there was just this like a local peak last summer where there was this overlap of the format was sorting itself out in the ban of, you know, Wake of Lurrus ban. Ledger Shredder got printed and like the metagame struck at the right time where Izzet was just dominant and unbeatable and just looked absurd. And in the pre-Lurrus era, it certainly fell away due to like Lurrus reasons a bit faster. But I think that people have sort of started to figure out just like the basic structural things you need in order to beat the deck.
Mm-hmm. So let's get into our main topic here in Scam, because it is a deck whose results have been quite hard to ignore over the past few months. I remember the Mana Traders event at the end of last year that I came second in. I lost a Scam in the finals in the course of its 11-0 run in the course of that tournament, several other copies in the top eight, and then in the challenges that went along concurrently that weekend, there were several copies in each of those as well, and that felt like just another weekend at the office for that deck. That didn't feel outside of the normal bounds of what you'd expect by any means, and so eventually you have to think this deck is more than just this one-trick wonder. It's more than the central gimmick of the deck, and at some point, you're not being scammed. You are just running into the expected range of outcomes that happened to you in that matchup.
Yeah, I think that that is like an important thing to notice with the deck, is that the basic draw, like there are the very flashy scam draws, and it really makes the deck come off like a one trick pony. It's like, oh, that can't happen every time. And it doesn't, but that's not like the entire roster of the deck. I think we'll get a bit to that when we start talking about like what hands you get to keep in mulligans, but I think it might be better to start from the top about like, where did Scam come from? What sort of made it a breakout deck to begin with outside of the fall of, you know, Murktide? And then I guess we'll bridge that right into some other topics.
Yeah, the actual origin story is fairly hard to place. I know that a lot of the Quebec guys were turning up to the face-to-face opens in the, you know, Ontario, Quebec regions with the deck, and that was what first put it on my radar. I don't know if they got inspiration for that from some Magic Online decklist dump that they found or what have you, but that's where it first got on my radar. And then as to what tipped me over into finally registering it myself, it is very easy to gain a lot of respect for a deck when you're losing to it over and over again. And if you're playing Primeval Titans in your deck, you will certainly lose a Scam an awful lot. That is, I think, Amulet's worst matchup by far among the mainstream decks. But when I was playing against the deck, you know, obviously I lose in the ways that you would expect. The Scam deck is doing its thing, but it also seemed like there were lots of games that should seem winnable where the Scam deck was just overpowering me anyway. And it felt like when I was trying other stuff in an attempt to branch out and expand my range, so to speak, Scam was the deck that impressed me the most and the one that I seriously considered switching to before I did. And so for this past weekend, the Mana Traders monthly series here in February, I resolved to actually finally grasp that nettle and switch to something else. And Scam was really the only deck that called to me on that level by that point.
Yeah, I think that like my path to liking this deck was, I guess, sort of the reverse, where I had spent a long time playing Murktide at like the very early stages of Scam being popular. And that deck was just like that matchup, especially at the time, I think, was just like very good for the Murktide player. And like, I just didn't really get what Scam had to offer. And then as I was like slowly forced off of Murktide and started playing Yawgmoth and Creativity and all these other decks, I was just kind of running into Scam. And that's when the problem started. And that was finally when I was like, okay, maybe it's time to just like, I don't know, put a 4/3 menace into play and see how that rolls. And yeah, the deck's just really powerful and really good and all around solid.
Yeah, let's start with the Murktide matchup then, because that is the one thing that I think, so the consensus goes, is keeping Scam from further success, because I think the theory is the Murktide deck has enough varied interaction to contain your most explosive starts, and then if you get into a longer game, well, they're going to outmuscle you in terms of card advantage with Expressive Iteration, and then they can exploit the lack of hard removal in the Scam deck by just plopping down a massive Murktide region and really putting you to the test. And if you don't have one of your two copies of Terminate or something, then you might just be dead to rights. And so when I chose the deck myself, I thought, well, I didn't expect to fade the Murktide matchup, because Murktide has been the most popular deck in any modern tournament, and that's the issue, right? Is that if one matchup among the commonly played decks is bad, that's one thing. When it's a deck which is just always there and has this massive fan following and is quite sticky in the sense that even if it's not as good as advertised or as it was in the past, people still play it anyway. Doesn't matter if you think personally it's a bad choice now, people will play it, and if you think this is a bad matchup, they probably will beat you. I also, given that I was effectively picking up Scam for the first time, didn't have many reps in the matchup myself, I thought that that experience or skill edge might be leveraged against me. So I thought, well, if I get paired against Murktide a lot, this is going to be an uphill battle. As it turns out, I went 4-0 in the tournament against Murktide, including a pair of wins against Max Kominowski, Twinless Twin, the author of one of the more prominent Murk guides out there, if you're interested in picking the deck up yourself. So I was beating Murktide pilots who definitely knew their stuff, and the matchup did not actually feel that difficult, either on the fundamentals or given the specific changes I had made to hedge with that matchup in mind.
Well, I mean, I think that you sort of cited one of the things where, like, yeah, people will play Murktide if it's not the best deck because it's a 45% deck or whatever versus the world. I think that you can kind of make the same excuse for the Rakdos matchup against Murktide, where, like, at the end of the day, like, you could just break the right way on all these Raghavan lineups. And, like, if you remember, I guess, almost 2 years ago now, like, the early stages of how you build Raghavan decks post Modern Horizons, it took a while for people to come around to Murktide over Rakdos or whatever. And that's just because a lot of these matchups, like, as long as you have some form of interaction for the Murktide region and, like, things you are doing that are relevant, you're, like, you can't be that far behind in these mirrors. And I don't think the matchup, like, even if you want to argue, like, small points and try and figure out all the edges you can get with Rakdos, like, let's just strike it back and say, like, from the, you know, whatever Rakdos made its post shadow, like, we need to play Terminate's update to beat Murktide region, I don't think the Rakdos versus Izzet matchup has ever been more than a, you know, few percent either way unfavored. Like, it's just, it's close enough that you can kind of shrug it off and move on if you'd like the rest of the metagame.
Mm-hmm. And so to get into the ways that I hedge against that matchup in particular, the first thing was I wanted enough removal that could deal with specifically Ledger Shredder at all points in the game. So instead of having this mix of Lightning Bolts and Fatal Pushes, I just had four main deck Fatal Push. And so that gives you the enough answers, although could use a few more to a turn one rank advantage, especially on the draw, but also means that you can fight over a 2/4 ledger shredder or especially in the post board games, Unlicensed Hearse is a really big card from both sides. And then I had the third Terminate in the main deck as well, cut away at a few other things to find room for that. Would frankly like to have a fourth in my ideal, you know, post sideboard configuration against Murktide, just to deal with the titular Murktide among other things there. And then in the sideboard, I had the last two copies of Fable of the Mirrorbreaker, taking me up to 4 Seasoned Pyromancer and 4 Fable in the 75, and then 2 Unlicensed Hearses, which ideally I would like the third, you know, would swap out Leyline of the Void for a hearse at this point. And so what that let me do in a kind of larger holistic sense was directly address all of those pain points in the matchup. So do I have enough removal for the big threats that can punk me out of the game? Yes. And then in these longer games, because we're trading cards off early, well, I need to go toe-to-toe with their expressive iterations. But once I have 4 Pyromancer, 4 Fable, and things like if the game's going long, then maybe I'm hardcasting Fury instead of just evoking it, hardcasting Grief, finding ways to use my mana, I actually felt pretty comfortable just playing those longer games against Murktide. And then Unlicensed Hearse was a really big deal too. So there is of course, a nice preemptive way to contain or delay or shrink a Murktide region, but also just as a threat in the matchup, just keeping Delirium in check and being a card which is both disruptive and will eventually be a serious threat in its own right. I just felt quite comfortable navigating those games, and you still have lots of decisions to make. It is a grindy matchup with everything that comes with that, but in terms of the tools I was bringing to the table, pivoting into this more mid-range plan, which I think is actually going against the core identity of the deck in some ways, and we'll come back to that in a bit, it felt not as difficult as advertised, even with the lack of experience I was bringing to the matchup.
So one thing that I've noticed from playing the matchup in the past that I think not even just like the individual cards, but the quantity of them that you have brings to the table is that you are able, I guess, I don't know if you were doing this, but were you trimming significantly on Feign Deaths and on Dying Malices after sideboarding?
I was. I had, I think, generally about 4 copies total of those effects as opposed to the 6 or 7 you normally have. And then I was also shaving on Griefs as well, because I was finding you don't want to use it just as Unmask, but then if you're de-emphasizing the Feign Death aspect, then well, the kind of 1-2 punch of Grief plus Feign Death is less likely as well. And it's not clear that you always want to do that anyway. And if you think the matchup's going long in the first place, then just abstractly, the idea of attacking their hand in a narrow window when they have a few turns to draw out of it looks less appealing as well.
Yeah. So one of the places that you actually lost the biggest percentage in that matchup is when they drew their Relic of Progenitus after sideboarding, because it was such a big problem for X percent of your hands, and you had nothing to mirror that loss of percentage the other way. So if you just reduce that percentage by cutting cards that are directly negated by Relic and moving out of the graveyard by cutting all these Feign Deaths and whatever, that's like a huge add. And all that is just if you have a raw quantity of non-graveyard cards, whether that's Fable, Hearse, I assume you were boarding in like Night's Whisper and maybe the 4th Thoughtseize, and like,
yeah,
just having like stuff that goes into the deck.
Yeah, so I had a few copies of Feign Death sticking around, and sometimes you got to do the scam combo with Fury, but for the most part, this was a protection spell of sorts for my Ragavan, for my Voidwalker, and between Fable and Seasoned Pyromancer, I had a lot of ways to cash in these dead or conditional cards for other stuff that might be more useful. So that applies to the Feign Death effects, but also applies to a card like Thoughtseize, right? Where sometimes in a drawn out mid game where both players have traded off, that's just the last thing you want a top deck. And then, you know, if I had a surplus of removal spells, well, one of those can become something else. So I found that having those rummaging effects was a big part of that recipe as well.
Yeah, I know in the past a Liliana of the Veil has made its way in for one of those like generic card slots that just pumps things up. I don't think there's a real reason to do that now because literal Murktide is not the like hard thing you're targeting, but it's worth considering if there's ever a point where like the next two best decks are like sort of soft to Liliana.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think once you get into the territory of all the various versatile 3-drops or what have you, there are a lot of options, and it's unclear exactly what mix you want, but I don't think that more of those is necessary, I would say.
What you mean you can't just add like a three drop and point to the grindy matchup over and over and then have a functional deck?
Well, one of my scam opponents in the mirror had Phyrexian Flesh Gorger, which is kind of an interesting option against the various red decks, including the mirror. And so I thought, well, that seems pretty tempting. I might try and incorporate that into my list myself moving forward. But then I'm already boarding up to 8 3 drops in these matchups. How many can I really afford before something starts to give?
Yeah, I think that's probably, I mean, there's 8 in your main deck, right? But like Blood Moon doesn't really count. It's like a 3, you know, it's like a Splinter Twin, a 4 drop is, you know, it's a different kind of argument.
Yeah, you're never going to have the Moon Effects and the Flesh Gorgers in your deck at the same time. And that maybe goes for something like the Lilianas as well. But yeah, I really liked having the ability to go up to the full 8 pack of Pyromancers plus Fables. It sounds flippant to say Fable is just a really good card. And especially I think in a deck like this where so much of your various plans that just run away with the game by themselves and get you those free wins, whether it's just Uncontested Ragavan or the Evoke plus Feign Death plan or just Voidwalker in some matchups, all of these are kind of Baneslayers, if you like. These are just, I have one singular threat, I'm going to challenge you to deal with it, and I will present this steady stream of those threats until you run out of answers or one of them takes over. And when you have these cards like Fable and Pyromancer, which just really line up nicely against one-for-one removal, then that lets you re-trump people who are just loading up on removal spells. So against the four-color decks, which I think had a pretty good weekend, especially in the Mana Traders event, like when I play Tamon Ragavan, they feel the need to solitude it to stop hitting them, and then they're able to just follow up with Fable, Pyromancer, or what have you. It feels like I am outcarding the deck whose explicit mission statement is to win the grindy matchups and get these favorable exchanges.
Yeah, just don't let them resolve their five drop and it's fine.
Yes, and it turns out Blood Moon, really nice way to prevent those decks from resolving their five drop. So you're using every part of the buffalo there.
Yeah, I would describe it, your opponent doesn't cast any spells as a route to victory. Yeah. So the Murktide matchup might be, you know, you mentioned it's going against the philosophy of the deck. The general premise of this deck is, like, much more of, I don't know, maybe it's sort of like the Eldrazi decks of the past, where, like, your primary plan is just, like, make one big thing that runs away with the game, and then, like, some percentage of the time you have to play the rest of the game. Is, like, what percentage of the time would you say you are actually a fair deck versus just, like, doing one specific thing that ends the game?
I think being a fair deck is the posture that you are forced into a lot of the time, and you certainly can play that game well, and that's part of why the deck is so strong, I would argue. But ultimately, you don't want to be a fair deck or a mid-range deck, and I think that's the confusion that a lot of people have with it when looking at it for the first time. And it's a natural confusion to have, because you think back to the Boomer John decks of yore, or like the Rakdos mid-range decks in Modern currently, which I think are a much more successful version of that template, where, yeah, you've got these cheap threats, you got this versatile interaction where, yeah, like against most decks, Fatal Push is going to do something, and when it doesn't, well, I have Thought Seizers, I have Duresses I can replace them with, and then one nice thing about the bounty of cards that these decks have had in recent years is, yeah, if I draw the wrong card from my deck, and that's the classic mid-range problem, well, I can pitch those to the cards that are also my threats. So I can, you know, cash in a Blood Token for my Bloodtithe Harvester. I can pitch my dead Fatal Push to Fable and draw some new cards instead. And so instead of being just like Rakdos mid-range brackets derogatory, it's just a good deck now. There's no shame in being a mid-range deck. And so I think it's natural for people who are taking that experience from Pioneer or from Modern from 5 years ago or whatever, and trying to apply that to this deck, I think that is the wrong way to look at it. I think that this deck is a, like, this wonky, not even a linear deck, because that implies more of a singular path than I think this deck is forced into. But I think what you're trying to do with this deck is something fundamentally powerful. And you have a few different options for what that can be. So against some opponents, you are a one-card combo deck. You are get to 3 mana and cast Blood Moon. Or against like Living End or something, it's get to 2 mana, cast Douthi Voidwalker. Sometimes it's I play my Ragavan, and if it lives, or if I can force it through, well, that's the game by itself. Sometimes it is double grief you on turn one. It's make an 8/8 effectively Fury, and well, now I might just kill you on turn three. You have lots of ways to do something fundamentally powerful, and you have enough of those, and they kind of operate in different ways that your draws can feel a bit disjointed sometimes. But that's okay, because if you have a Blood Moon preventing them from casting any spells, you can afford to draw, you know, a dead Blood Moon or a dead something else. If you're killing them on turn three with a Fury, doesn't really matter what's left in your hand as the Detritus. It's fine. You can handle that. So if the mission statement of a normal mid-range deck is, I want to depolarize my draws, I want all my cards to kind of do something, and one reason those decks are so alluring is they get to play magic, in air quotes, in most of their games, even if that doesn't amount to enough in the end. This deck, you have to be quite comfortable with trying to do something broken, mulliganing in order to let yourself do something broken, and understanding that in a lot of games, you will be placing all of your chips on this one card or this one line. And yeah, sometimes you run into their two outer or whatever, and it doesn't get there, but that's just the risk you took, and it was a smart risk to take. And you have to take those risks in a way that your, you know, Thoughtseize into Tarmogoyf deck seemed explicitly designed to prevent you from having to take.
Yeah, well, I do want to highlight that, like, the risk of this under disruption. So one of the problems with modern decks that have tried to move all in like this over the last 2 years or so, since actually it's almost 4 years, Modern Horizons 1 was really the turning point. But like, if you get hit with disruption and you have a Poetic Ritual in hand, that is a dead card. The cards like that in this deck are what? Like Grief, Fury, Blood Moon is still like fairly relevant across the board, even when it's not shutting off everything. Like just choking your opponent on a couple spells is a big deal. And then like, you sort of mentioned this in the Murktide matchup, but Feign Death and Undying Malice are just cards you can use against interaction, removal, and combat. Like, your Raghavan getting Feign Death is like drawing another Raghavan. Like, it's really the same thing. I think that, like, you are mulliganing to a specific powerful thing you are doing under the knowledge that the top of your deck will actually supply you with things to carry on if you fail is, like, a very big and important component of this deck.
Yeah, and that's an angle that hadn't occurred to me until you just laid it out, which is that your combo pieces, if that's how you want to think about it, enable each other and play off each other in a way that, yeah, if you're a Storm deck and you draw the second dead Poetic Ritual, well, if the first one was bad, the second one's probably bad. In this deck, you know, if you stumble for a bit and you take a turn or two to assemble your Fury plus Feign Death, well, that might actually work to your advantage in the sense that they have now develop their battlefield, and now Fury, two Fury triggers, it's going to clean all of that up. Likewise with your Grief plus Feign Death, right? You grief them once, you Feign Death again, and then if you draw another Feign Death, that's not a dead part B of your A plus B combo. That is another layer of protection for that threat that you're trying to protect. Or yeah, maybe if you draw another Grief instead, well, okay, you grief them again and take the one remaining piece of action out of their hand. So even the cards in this deck, which seem the most conditional, when you do get to do your thing, having more copies of those pieces let you do the thing again or continue doing the thing. And that's a really nice virtue for a deck like that to have.
Yeah. Also, just like the part where you cash them out for raw cards sometimes on like a Reflection of Kiki Jiki or a Pyromancer, or like the Dothi Voidwalker thing where you cast their spell and then get back the Voidwalker isn't super common, but it does come up.
Yeah, or even just Dothi Voidwalker and protecting it from removal so that you get to untap with your Voidwalker, because if you do, then you're off to the races. So yeah, the intended use of those Feign Death effects is to pair with your Evoke creatures, but you can find ways to do things with them, even with the three drops, right? So Seasoned Pyromancer, Feign Deathing that often lets you kind of chain those together and combo off, so to speak. And then with Fable as well, if that transforms into Reflection of Kiki Jiki, well, the onus is on them to remove that before it gets to untap. And so if you Feign Death your Reflection, it comes back as Fable, which sometimes is an upside, sometimes it's a downside, but you do get to go through the entire story there to relive all of that once again. So when you think of, okay, there are these 8 combo pieces, if you like, that work with those effects, but then you also have another 12 to 14 cards that work with them in some capacity, that lets you feel a lot more safe in just embracing that element of the deck.
Yeah, so I guess like talking about Fable and Pyro, I noticed, you know, it's pretty common for the deck to be a bunch of Pyros and less Fables. Do you have strong opinions? I mean, you obviously have the Fables in the sideboard and main deck split leaning towards Pyro. What are some of the reasons that you might favor Pyro over Fable in this deck?
I think the immediacy of Pyro is a big deal. So in a deck where you have the 8 evoke creatures that you can cast for free, and then you have a bunch of 1-mana threats and interaction, if you're missing one piece of your A plus B thing, well, Pyromancer can get you that other piece right away. You can often, in the mid game, cast Pyro, draw 2 cards, and play one of them in the same turn in a way that you can't with Fable. And then, given that the Ragavan mirrors are such a big part of the format at present, Pyromancer almost being guaranteed to gum up the board against Ragavan, you know, if you can create even just one of the elemental tokens, that is a lot different from you make a goblin with Fable, they swat that away, and that's, you know, part of the card's value in the first place, and then they just keep hitting you with Ragavan. So the immediacy of Pyromancer, I think, is a big deal there. The fact that, you know, you can, if you draw several copies of these effects, you can loot away the first Pyromancer and then still get marginal value from the graveyard for it. And then because you do empty your hand so quickly, you often don't have redundant things that you can toss away to that second chapter of Fable in quite the same way. Whereas with Pyromancer, you can deploy your hand and then use the Pyromancer as this Muldrifter of sorts to refuel. Because if your hand is empty, you don't need to discard N cards in order to draw N cards. You know, if you play Pyromancer with an empty hand, you just draw 2 cards and you're very happy with that.
Yeah, I think that's also just more common because the deck mulligans so often. So you're starting down a card, so it's just easier to be on 0 cards and actually draw 2 off Pyro. I guess the other thing that kind of got lost in the shuffle here is that you're just more likely to discard a spell to Pyro than you are in like any other deck I've played, just because your Feign Deaths or Blood Moons might just not be castable, or like your Fatal Push. There's just so many more conditional cards in this deck than there are in anything else. And like, you're already low on lands. So Pyro is often, like you said, the immediacy of cards, but just like the immediacy of power. It's often just 4 power for 3. And you're not really discarding things that you cared about. Like, it's, you know, the Fable thing where it's like, usually when you're discarding 2 cards with Fable, it's very rare that it's 2 spells. I mean, this deck just like, that's a very common thing.
Yeah. The other side of that is, if you have something that you want to keep, often that is going to dissuade you or prevent you from casting your Pyromancer. So, for example, you have, let's say, 2 cards left over. One of them is a Fury. If you have Pyromancer, well, you have to cash that Fury in. There's nothing optional about that. Excuse me. Whereas if you have a Fable, often you can play the Fable. Next turn, you draw up to 3 cards. You pitch the 2 non-Fury cards. And now you're likely to find a redundant red card that you can pitch to Fury, or if you're looking for the Feign Death effect for the full scam combo, then you can find that as well. So there are upsides and downsides, and in the post-board games where you go up to the full 8, there will often be some interesting choices about exactly which one you want to lead with if given the choice. But I think prioritizing Pyromancer in the main deck and then being able to go up to the full 8 pack makes sense to me.
Yeah, and I also do want to note that, like, this is not a deck that tends to utilize the treasure tokens off Fable especially well, in my experience. I've kind of had the experience where, like, the treasure off Ragavan matters a lot because you have such a glut at 3, or, like, you know, having, like, these turns where you're playing, you know, a 2-drop and a 1-drop, just, like, a lot of things to deploy in this medium amount of mana. But often, like, Fable triggers and you just, like, play the land and, like, maybe it pushes you towards hard casting a Fury, but that's about it that the treasure does.
Yeah, that was one of the main draws to Fable for me in the core that I mentioned last week of, I've been brainstorming all of these different, you know, 4 Ragavan, 4 Fury, 4 Fable, 4 Pyromancer decks. And this is basically the headline act for that. And one issue that I ran into is, am I just building a worse version of Scam? One thing that some of those other decks did do more effectively is using the treasure tokens to bridge towards a hardcast Fury and to just accelerate that out earlier. Whereas in this deck, it's pretty rare that you send the token in. Often that's going to be this kamikaze mission just to get that treasure token. And then you need to have another untapped land in your deck that has Blackleaf Cliffs and maybe like 19 to 20 lands total. It's easier said than done. And, you know, you don't have that many ways to actually go up on cards. And often you're going to be pitching redundant lands to your Fable or your Pyromancer in the first place. So the idea of using the Fable to jump up to Fury doesn't come up as often as you would think. Having said that, I mean, there still have been a lot of games where the game drags on. Fable finds me either the Fury or the lands to cast it, and then Reflection pairs with Fury to just devastate their entire board. So it does come up, but it's that specific kind of aggressive line is not as common as I would like it to be.
Maybe you can push the Obosh scam deck where you have Obosh and you've cut grief and you're just scamming Fury, and I haven't really figured out the details, but at that point, then you can use the mana off Fable to find the Obosh, and that's where you get paid.
I'm sure Young Dingo has tried that and streamed it at some point, and it doesn't seem totally implausible to me, but for now, I'm going to stick with the tried and true formula.
Yeah, you have to. Really, I think the biggest loss would be, like, actually, all the cards that are even cost in this deck are just really important. It's just all bad. Don't do this at home. I mean, you can do it at home, but just, like, I don't know. You're allowed to tell anybody if you do.
I think if you want to do this, then the Boros Obosh deck that won the challenge and then kept putting up good results in the same player's hands in the future challenges, I think that is a perfectly legitimate alternative to explore, and you can build that in a more scammy way if you like. That deck can support and maybe should support some copies of Ephemerate as well. So if you are an Obosh enjoyer, which I could see myself becoming partial to that, then I think that's where you want to be. For now, though, you know, the scam life is good. We don't need to mess it up here.
Yeah, I guess on the subject of, you know, even cost cards that have kind of disappeared from the deck in favor of good stuff, have we seen the, like, slow/rapid demise of Kroxa across every format in, like, every deck? That card, I think maybe the death knell for it in Modern is what I talked about with the Murktide matchup, where, like, the problem is how good their graveyard hate is against you, so you just aren't allowed to have cards for the grindy matchup that are graveyard dependent, and that's what Kroxa really was.
Yeah, that is a big problem. I've almost wanted it most in something like the Prowess matchup, where you kind of have to trade one for one with them, but you can't do that sustainably because they just go over the top with not just iteration, but stuff like Underworld Breach, Light Out the Sage, and so on. And so you need an actual big threat that can get the job done. And Kroxa is not an immediate threat, but it's an eventual threat, and maybe you have to settle for that. But as you say, in matchups where it should be at its best, like the Mirror or Murktide or stuff like John Saga or something like that, they're going to have a lot of graveyard hate. And even if they're overestimating how good that is against you, especially if you're shaving down on these Feign Death effects, well, if you have Kroxa and you're relying on Kroxa, then the graveyard hate is still going to be good against you. So I think that is an issue. And you have enough ways to win those grind fights instead, whether it's the full set of Fables, or I had a Night's Whisper in my sideboard as well, the Phyrexian Flesk Orders even. Lots of routes you can explore. I think the Kroxa just, as much as I want it to be good, just doesn't really fill the niche that it needs to justify a slot in the deck when there are so many cards competing for those slots in the first place.
Yeah, I would actually cite the Burn matchup as like the peak of Kroxa, and at that point, I don't, you know, it's just like a functional Burn hate card. I don't know, that's just not where you want to be.
Yeah, if you want a card for Burn, Phyrexian Flesk Order, baby, let's go. Or like, I don't know, Collective Brutality. There's other stuff in Kroxa that is far down that list as well. So it's not the best at any one thing, and it leans into an existing vulnerability that the rest of the deck, at least allegedly, seems to have.
Yeah, so I guess your sideboard is, I guess, sort of unique relative to a lot of other people's. Let's talk about like some of the common things that people are trying to do against this deck when they're sideboarding against it, and how you're trying to solve that. And I guess let's just start with Sanctifier on back, because that has been the card that immediately comes to mind for me. I've been playing with some of the mono white Shining Shoal Humans deck this week. Oh, and that card as a 4X in that deck has been like, oh yes, this is exactly the purpose of it, and this is one of the reasons this deck is good. And like, yeah, that is a problem for scam, and you need some way to handle it.
I would argue, actually, that deck evinces some of that same philosophy, where if you try to be a straight-up mono-white humans deck, you'll win your games here and there, but you're going to have to work hard for it. That deck has a lot of ways to just punk out certain people, whether it's drawing Sanctifier on deck against Scam or Murktide or the Shining Shoal thing, or yeah, sometimes you just run them over with like a protected Adeline or something. Like that deck, to me, understands the challenges that it faces more than just anyone who rocks up with like classic five color humans with one or two cards from the Modern Horizons sets.
Yeah, we can discuss that deck a little bit more in the results, because it had a great weekend. But I am very impressed with that deck, and I would expect to, I don't know if I want to say I would expect to see a lot more of it moving forward, but it is like, functional is underselling it, but like, when you think about the history of Champion of the Parish since 2019, like, this is a functional humans deck should say something.
Yeah, everybody should get the feeling of casting a big Shining Soul sometime in their life, and I'm glad that more people will experience that now.
Yes, I have not redirected like a 6 or a 7 yet, but I'm waiting.
Going back to Sanctifier on Vec, I think Hammer is one of the consensus bad matchups that is actually pretty bad, and I don't know how much of that is just the presence of Sanctifier in the sideboard, but it's not part of it, I'll put it that way. And so however much double counting is involved, you need a plan for Sanctifier, and so whether that's stuff like your Pyrite Spell Bomb or there are various options you can go towards. Path of Peril was one that was in vogue briefly. I went for Engineered Explosives because I think this is one of the best cards in the Hammer matchup in general, so expecting to put it on one, clean up a board full of Sigarda's Aids and Hammers and Esper Sentinels, just the whole thing, it just gets it all out of there. But also, you know, Rhinos is on the uptick. I think I played against it 3 times in this tournament, and it was a fantastic sideboard card to have there, and it's just a nice thing to have more generally. So I don't actually know if you want it to be part of the plan against a deck like Creativity. It has an obvious application there. I don't know if it's a good one, but you know, if you decide that should be part of the puzzle, well, it's there for you as well. And then just in general, there are decks where Explosives is really good against them. So yeah, my teammate who had been doing really well with Scam in our team events lost to Merfolk a few weeks ago, and that's a matchup where, like, oh, you can see how that might be difficult. And historically, and it's still true now, Explosives one of the best cards against that. So it's a good card against the known predators that you have to face, and also a good card just against stuff. And there's a lot of stuff in Modern, and that's what has kept us in business week by week.
Yeah, well, I guess my question about cards like Yee in this deck, and also Hearse, is how do you mitigate adding a colorless card to your deck that is just trying to have cards with good colors in the first place?
I think some of that is, if you're boarding this in because you expect it to be a reliably good card in the matchup, you're not really looking to pitch it in the first place, except as a last resort. And so that's definitely true of Hearse against Murktide. It's going to be true of Explosives in the matchups where you board Explosives in. And so I don't think that is necessarily a deal breaker. It can come up, but usually I think if it is coming up, then you're in dire straits anyway, and you probably needed that colorless card to bail you out of it.
Okay, so you're basically saying, like, you don't really care. Like, you're just going to pitch whatever else you have in hand. It's just, like, if you have this card, that is the thing you are scamming them with.
Yes, but also, this is mainly true in the Hearse matchups. I think in those, you expect those to be these drawn-out slugfests, and so you're going to draw more cards, you're going to find cards to pitch instead, and you also don't need to do that in such a timely fashion, so I haven't played enough of the Scam Mirror to know how often you are just shoving on a double Grief or double Fury on turn one. But given that there are enough answers to that line on both sides, I can see it being the case that, yeah, if you're building towards that at all, it's going to be a few turns down the line. And so, yeah, you don't need the redundant card of exactly this color to pitch on turn one. You might need some card of some color to pitch on turn 3 or 4. And that's a much easier ask.
That's totally fair. And I think the Murktide point is probably best illustrated by, like, you're already boarding out the Undying Malices and Feign Death, so the Evoke plan is just kind of a secondary, and, like, adding colorless cards there is not a big deal.
Mm-hmm. And I don't know which other colorless cards are in contention necessarily, but yeah, I think that's an important principle to keep in mind, is that if you are boarding these cards in because you think these are high impact sideboard cards, well, definitionally these are going to be near the bottom of the list in terms of stuff you actually want to pitch in the first place. And then all of these cards, no matter what they are, pitch as well to Seasoned Pyromancer or Fable as anything else. And that highlights something that goes against what I said earlier, where if you think of this as a combo deck, as a linear deck, where you have these high impact cards that you want in specific matchups, that suggests you want to be mulliganing aggressively to find those cards. That being said, though, there is a good argument in a deck that has 8 pitch elementals and Fable and Pyromancer of having just stuff in hand, like raw cardboard, raw material to pitch of those. And so if you're thinking, you know, you're looking at a 7, weighing this up against the marginal 6 card hand, or you're looking at a 6 thinking about going to 5, if it is marginal, the fact that this is a 7 card hand instead of a 6 card hand, or n cards instead of n-1, that actually is a relevant point in a way that it might not be otherwise.
Yeah, that point of tension there is kind of good to bring up, especially because when we're talking about these cards, we're talking about like more naturally interactive sideboard games, whereas like game one, you can kind of get away with like, I don't know, these five cards do that. Maybe not so much after sideboarding. That's sort of like the sideboard principles. I guess the other sideboard card that you had that I'm kind of interested about is Leyline of the Void, not Night's Whisper. I actually like have really enjoyed the copy of Night's Whisper or whatever to kind of reverse that card disadvantage issue. But like, is Leyline specifically aimed at the mirror? Were you expecting a lot of dredge in this event? What was going on there?
It was aimed at the mirror, and that was only because I asked around people who I know had played Scam in the past, what do you think the best plan is in the mirror? And the general answer was, IDK, I just have some ley lines and I bring them in, which I thought, okay, well, that seems good enough if that's what everyone else is doing. Didn't actually come up for me in practice, and I'm not sure if that is a reliable plan in the mirror. It seems fine. If I had them, I would bring them in. Also, you know, great card against Yawgmoth, good against Living End, of course. For the most part, those are matchups where you don't really need the help. I did bring them in against one Merchant opponent that was especially graveyard-centric, so they had four Dragon's Rage Channelers, I think, may have been the full four Murtide Regents as well, and then the usual Unholy Heats and so on. So at that point, that did seem worth it, whereas when I played against Twinus Twin, who had a single Dragon's Rage Channeler, which I wasn't even sure if that would stay in the deck, given the quantity of graveyard hate that I had, and a lot more of these beefier cyborg cards like Seasoned Pyromancers of his own, Subtlety, Fury, and so on. At that point, the idea of drawing this mostly dead ley line on turn three or four just seemed like too big of a cost to bear. So I think you can be flexible with the card in the Murtide matchup in particular, but if you're not relying on it there and you're not sure how good it is in the mirror, I don't think it's worth it in general. So that's how I might free up some space. I think if I'm going to have the third unlicensed Hearst in one of those slots going forward, and I'm not sure if I would actually have any ley lines at all unless I thought it was really the only game in town for the mirror.
So you're not saying you're a one ley line philosophy believer?
I think the list that I recommended to Corey for this weekend does actually have a single ley line in the sideboard, but I don't think that is off the table the way that other people seem to.
Okay. Yeah, I'm totally here for it. The one ley line plan is totally fine. There's math behind it. It sort of doesn't make sense in this deck where the cost of drawing ley line is so low, but there's math about like the ratio of how often you hit it in your opener versus how often you draw a dead ley line. I don't know. Listen, it's fine. I do want to talk about the other like notable part of your sideboard where you have more Blood Moons in your sideboard than the main deck. Being a two moon Blood Moon deck is more a statement about Blood Moon these days, I think, where it's not actually the best card. It just happens to be the best card when it is the best card.
Yeah, I think if you look at the spread of decks that I played against in the event, so played against Murktide four times, played against Rhinos three times, played against Scam once. These are other Blood Moon decks. These are decks where you want as few main deck Blood Moons as possible. There was actually a really funny moment in one of the Murktide matchups where my opponent in game one played Ragavan. I didn't have the removal spell. They attacked me, flipped one of my main deck Blood Moons, and then tanked for a solid 3 or 4 minutes. And I was wondering exactly what they were thinking about. And so eventually they played the Blood Moon because my first land had been Blackleaf Cliffs. And so I think their thought process was, Blood Moon against Scam, if they don't have a basic swamp, can actually be pretty effective. It's really limiting to what they can do. And they had this Ragavan that was uncontested so far, so probably going to still be uncontested going forward. And so that would let them cast the, you know, the double blue spells in their hand, even if they only had one basic island to work with at that point. As it happened, I was able to untap, play Basic Swamp from hand, Fatal Push their Ragavan, play my own Ragavan, and now they were stuck with two counter spells in hand that they couldn't cast, and I was just off of the races. So they locked themselves out of the game with my own Blood Moon, which was fun to see. But yeah, that doesn't happen all that often. And in general, yeah, if you expect that kind of matchup spread, then I don't know if you want the main deck Blood Moons at all. That being said, when Blood Moon is good, it is really, really good, often the best card you could ask for, and at the point where you don't have main deck Blood Moons, I don't know if Amulet is actually a good matchup anymore, for example, or, you know, Creativity. I was struggling with more than I expected to, frankly, and Blood Moon is the best card against them as well. So especially with like the Omnath decks coming up, or just the card Urza Saga having a good weekend, even if Hammer itself did not, I think there are enough reasons to embrace Blood Moons. The question is, what distribution of them do you want? And so I think if you don't want many in the main deck, you still want those in the sideboard where that is the most high impact play. And so that's how I ended up with, as you said, more moons in my sideboard than I had in my 60.
Yeah, that all checks out to me. It is, you know, we are far off of the days. Like, creativity is one of the most played decks in the format, but not the most played deck. I mean, even the decks were like, I incidentally like Blood Moon against Hammer and Yawgmoth. Like, those decks are not significant percentages to the point where I'd want that. And, like, I don't know. I'm thinking back on, like, oh, yeah, Crashing Footfalls as the Cascade deck versus Living End. Like, the Living End matchup is good, but it is certainly better when you get to Blood Moon them out of the game a lot. A lot worse against Rhinos just because their deck is structurally designed as a Blood Moon deck, too. And also, just the raw quantity of Leyline Bindings just going down over time. Another strike against going really all in as Blood Moon as a primary plan.
Yeah, there's some question over, do you want the marginal Blood Moon effect to be a Blood Moon itself or a Magus in the Moon? They both have their pros and cons. I think that in the matchups where you want the Blood Moon effects the most, actual Blood Moon is better to put your chips on than Magus. So against creativity, you know, one gets answered by Lightning Bolt, Prismari Command, stuff like that, in a way that Blood Moon does not. I guess Passager is the one thing in the other column, but that is, I think it still weighs pretty heavily there. And then there's stuff like against, you know, Living End, for example, if they have Force Negation in, well, they can Force Negation your Blood Moon, but they can sell it to your Magus of the Moon, so that one maybe is kind of a wash. I think in general, Blood Moon is just the more solid card. But if you have, I guess if you want five of them, then the fifth one has to be Magus. The fourth one, I could see arguments both ways there. But I think prioritizing Blood Moon is the way to go at first.
Yeah, especially game one. It's just so much more likely that they just have a card that kills your Magus in their deck than a card that kills their Blood Moon. And then you can kind of, you know, balance out the rest of it after sideboarding, and again, just steal as many games as possible against Amulet players who have Bosaiju's in their deck with the Maguses.
Mm-hmm. That was actually one thing that tempted me towards Scam for this tournament, which is that it was open decklist, and I think Scam is a deck which really gains a lot from an open decklist field, where you know how safe it is to shove on Grief plus Feign Death, Fury plus Feign Death on turn one, whether that Blood Moon in your six card hand is the thing that redeems the entire six card hand, or it's the card that you want to tuck and you're going to keep the other six by default. So when you have so many cards that are polarized between matchups, I think just the open information that you get in game one does really go a long way there.
Yeah, absolutely agree. It's important, like, knowing what scam you are trying to run each game is a huge upgrade for what you're keeping in your hand.
Yeah, so as any scammer will tell you, you have to pick your marks carefully, and this lets you do that.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, we've talked about the overall pictures of the deck. Are there any micro details you kind of want to drive into about, like, actually playing the games beyond just running a scam?
I will say, I think this is the most interesting Ragavan deck that I've encountered in its close to 2 years in Modern at this point, because I think all of the following are actually pretty likely scenarios that can come up with Ragavan. So you can either cast Tome on Ragavan and you rely on that card surviving to pull you ahead, and that's kind of a line that's open to any Ragavan deck, is why the card is so good. But then you can also do any of the following. So cast a Tome on Ragavan almost intending for it to be this lightning rod for their removal spell because they feel obliged to remove it, and that clears the way for maybe a Doughty Voidwalker that you care about more, or this is what allows you to Fury plus Feign Death on turn two and allow that to go the distance because your Ragavan ate the Solitude instead. You can cast Tome on Ragavan, and then this is like the monkey troop line. You cast a Ragavan, they kill it, and then turn two, you cast another Ragavan with a Feign Death effect up, and so they need three removal spells to just move past the early Ragavan portion of the game. And even if they have all three, well, then the game continues and you can find something else to do instead. You can, if you don't have the full troop, if you only have one copy, well, sometimes you have an interesting debate of, do I cast it on turn one and hope for the best, or do I wait until turn two so that I have that layer of protection up with that Feign Death? Or sometimes you don't want to cast Ragavan at all because you're a deck that has Fury and Pyromancer and Fable, and you judge that it's unlikely enough that the Ragavan is going to do anything, that just having that that blank card or that red card to toss away to one of those is going to be its actual purpose instead. And so this is on top of the usual dance around, do I cast it on turn one or do I intend to dash it if they're a Prismatic Ending, Ren and Six deck, stuff like that. So there are a lot of layers two Ragavan in this deck, and that idea of, well, I'll just play Ragavan and protect it or run away with the game, you're not a great Ragavan deck in that regard, because you don't have the sheer quantity of removal of something like a normal Rakdos deck or Jund Saga, stuff like that. You don't have Murktide's mix of removal and counter spells to back it up and let it go the distance. So that idea of just, yeah, I'll place all my bets on Ragavan doesn't come up as often, but you have more ways to use a Ragavan than maybe any other Ragavan deck that I've ever seen before.
Yeah, it's very, you know, you said the like usual ways of like dash or not. Those decisions just feel like they're a lot easier with this deck as opposed to all the weird stuff that just would never pop up anywhere else.
There is also the turn one grief plus Ragavan hands, where that is actually a way to get your Ragavan through and have it survive a turn that no other deck really has access to. Like, this is the one overlap between the decks that have grief and the decks that have Ragavan.
I don't think I've ever successfully force of negationed a spell targeting my Ragavan, so that is a good point.
Yes. I will say as well that the deck is a lot less reliant on the Ragavan lines than you might think. So across, let's see, I played 12 matches over the course of the tournament when you factor in the weird structure on day two, and I think there was maybe one game, maybe two, where I just played a Ragavan and it just kept connecting and it ran away with the game. In that way, it's rare, but it's not necessary. And if it were, then the entire calculus would be different. As it is, it's a thing which you throw out there, and if they don't deal with it, great. And if they do, you have other things they have to deal with. And so it's part of a larger package, even though it can exist as this self-contained threat as well.
I might argue that has a bit to do with the whole positioning of is it in the metagame in general, and like the way that deck picked. There's two ways that deck picked up the most free rins, right? There's sometimes you have a Ragavan and your opponent can't stop it, and then there's Murktide Regent, and it feels like the metagame has shifted to really push back against those exact two things, and it happens that Ragavan is the overlap here, so people are just more prepared in general, so you have less of a window for your Ragavan to really run away with the game, but that's fine in this deck because you're not relying on it.
It probably didn't help that I won 1 out of 12 die rolls over the weekend, which sounds like just a bad beat and a weird complaint given that I still did well in the tournament, and it is, but you know, I let me have my moment here. But there is actually a relevant strategic point there, which is that all of the free wins that this deck has access to are much better on the play than they are on the draw. So you know, Ragavan famously, as anyone who has been on the wrong end of Ragavan can attest to, but also just, you know, Blood Moon, much better on the play than on the draw. Grief, just discard effects, Thoughtseize, often a lot better on the play than the draw. If you are shoving all in on Fury plus Feign Death, well, if you're on the play versus on the draw, that will often make the entire difference between can they answer it, can they not. And so the fact that the deck still was humming along and doing well for me, even though I was on the draw constantly, gave me a lot more faith in its kind of a general structural soundness, if that makes sense.
That is not a lot of die rolls to win.
And the one die roll I run, I lost the match, not as a result, but I lost the match. And so you, if you are of a certain mindset, that, at that point you start drawing links that shouldn't be drawn, and then, you know, but no, I wouldn't read too much into that, but I was glad that I had that kind of a trial by fire in one sense, because it really assuaged one of my main concerns about the deck.
Yeah, that's yeah, it is always nice to know that under the worst case scenarios where you play against Murktide every round and lose the die roll, your deck is capable of winning. The question is, maybe you lost the match, but did you win the game that you won the die roll?
No, absolutely not. So, yeah, again, not quite sure what to read into that, if anything. But yeah, it's I think that I had this varied enough range of experiences with the deck in general that like I saw how it operated under best case conditions, worst case conditions, and was impressed by each quarter of that quadrant, if you like. But I was not psychologically prepared for the swings that come with playing with and against Ragavan, where just the fact that, you know, I basically never got to untap and connect with the Ragavan, or my opponent's Ragavans were like top decking better from my own deck than I was with my own. Like, again, none of this stuff is a valid complaint necessarily, but I think that you see why just the experience of Ragavan is such a sore spot with so many people, to say nothing of its, you know, price point and ubiquity and whatever. Like, if you are someone who has sworn off Modern in recent months because of Ragavan, I'm at least willing to hear that out in a way that I wouldn't be with some of the other, you know, common bugbears that people point to.
Yeah, I mean, games ending on turn one is something that is generally a sore spot. Even if Ragavan allows, like, a lot of very generalized points of interaction, it's the whole kind of, you know, people are still upset about Glistener Elf because the game ends on turn one, so Ragavan is just, what, another Glistener Elf? It's kind of funny we're talking about this with Scam, because I think that, like, one of the things you're sort of describing is there's a lot less games that are decided by, like, my opponent played Circle of Protection red, and Scam is just, like, bringing every aspect of that gameplay back to the modern format.
Yeah, Scam maybe is Magic how Richard Garfield intended, right? Where you play some overpowered hate card and your opponent doesn't do anything, and hopefully they come back and play Magic again in the future, but I wouldn't guarantee it.
Yeah, I don't know. I think that maybe as a jumping off point, I guess it also integrates the other thing that people hate about Modern these days, which is just like, I think that the ubiquity of specifically the MH2 incarnations is a very in-your-face reminder for a lot of people who don't like I guess the best argument on their side would be, like, forced novelty of Modern Horizons 2. But at the same time, like, they are some of the most interesting cards to play with in the fair games with this deck, even if they do result in a lot of non-games. So, yeah, it's just all the aspects of Modern that I could see people having issues with. And yet somehow, like, I don't know, the complaints are still about Murktide.
Yeah, I think that this deck also reminds or validates people for their fears about grief when MH2 was being spoiled, where this was the thing. I think it helped that this was one of the first spoilers. This was our first taste of the set, and it was like, oh my god, if this is an indication of what the rest of the set is like, then maybe the sky really is falling. As it turned out, the whole grief plus ephemerate thing became marginal at best, and often it was completely invisible, and it was all of the other evoke elementals that played a much bigger role in the format. But this is at least a taste of, okay, this is why we were so worried about grief in the first place, because it does live up to its name sometimes.
Yeah, it's just really good. I don't know what else to say about, like, starting a game with a 4/3 creature and then putting your opponent's hand in the graveyard too. Just really good. Not a lot to say. Fury, you know, starting the game with a 4/4 double strike, even if it does nothing else, also great.
Yeah, and that segues neatly into something else, which is there's a surprisingly large range of Feign Death effects that you can play. So there are two literal copies of Feign Death. So Feign Death and Undying Malice is the same card, so you can play up to 8 of these effectively if you like. But there's also Undying Evil. So this is the one that gives a creature literal undying. The thing is there, so it brings the creature back untapped, which can be relevant against Ragavan, notably, or other blockers or attackers. But the fact that it doesn't protect a creature that has already been Feign Death is enough to disqualify that, I would argue. Yeah, I mean, I could buy some argument that if you fed this deck to a supercomputer for 2 weeks, it might come out with some, like, weird mix that I hadn't considered. But yeah, I think on that basis alone, I'm happy not playing Undying Evil. But then the real question mark for me is Manica Rebirth. So this is the Zendikar Rising modal DFC, where one half is a come into play tapped blackland, and then the other half is the Feign Death effect, if you like. So it brings it back, and you lose 2 life, you don't get the counter. The 2 life isn't nothing, but the lack of that extra +1/+1 counter was shockingly relevant for me, because if you are all in on, you know, a grief connecting a few times and relying on the menace to get a few attacks in before they can resent 2 blockers, well, each of those attacks being for 4 instead of 3, that's a big deal. Or the fact that you don't need to take their Unholy Heat because your grief is going to have 3 toughness instead of 4, that calculation changes if your grief is only going to have 2 toughness and now it's just going to die again before it can do anything. Also comes up a lot with Fury, because if you're trying to just present this, like, Hogak-esque clock on turn one, there's a big difference between a 3/3 with double strike and a 4/4 with double strike, especially against, you know, Lightning Bolt, against these other red decks and so on. So that was a lot more relevant than I expected it to be. That being said, I think there is a case for a mix of some kind, because you are a fairly land-light deck, and you do need to get to 3 mana for a lot of your big plays, especially in these post-ball games, or to get up to 5 for Fury and so on. And so it wouldn't shock me if the right mix was like 2 Rebirth and 4 to 5 of the other effects, though when I started looking at it for the first time, part of me was thinking, well, why wouldn't you just start with 4 Manica Rebirth and go from there? And that's why in the end.
I have just not been super happy with the ETB tapped land a lot of the time. When you are playing a lot of the games where you actually want to produce mana, there's not really a gap for you to basically spend that additional 1 mana, except for maybe turn 1 sometimes. I get that it does help you get there, but I think the value of that tapped land is not really a full land of value.
Yeah, I'm never happy to play it, but sometimes I'm happy that I have something where, like, so, you know, I scan them on turn 1, and then on turn 2, well, the only other thing my hand can do is cast a 3-drop eventually, and this is a second land, which means next turn I have outs to actually cast my 3-drop instead of just sitting there doing nothing and being all in on this one thing. I think that the first one is good. I think I do want the second one after my experience this weekend, but, like, my first impulse of why don't you start with 4 of these and work down, it goes the other way. You start with one of these maybe and work your way up.
Yeah, so I feel like we have talked about every single card slot in this deck that, you know, has been going on. So let's talk about the modern metagame in general. So we've talked about the Murktide matchup. You briefly touched on the Creativity matchup. What problems were you having there?
So what I thought was, this is going to be pretty simple because they're this, like, named card combo deck, but they don't have much redundancy on that named card. And I have a bunch of Griefs and Thought Seizes, so sometimes I'll strip that away and they won't do anything. Blood Moon is really good against them. I'm a Blood Moon deck. Douthi Voidwalker, even, often quite good against them. I'm a Douthi Voidwalker deck. And they don't have a ton of ways to just deal with a big thing, so sometimes you make a Fury and that would go all the way. So it seemed like every part of the Buffalo should do something against them. In practice, they have, like, just enough of each thing that even if you get to grief away that one copy of something or you shove all in on this one thing, I was finding that if I couldn't close the game out quickly, they could recover, and their own fables were phenomenal at, you know, bypassing Blood Moon and tying the whole room together there. So I still think it should be a decent matchup, and you can lean into it with more copies of Blood Moon and so on, but it wasn't as encouraging as I expected it to be necessarily.
That's totally fair. Their deck is full of a lot of actually good cards, and you can sometimes just get into bad good card fights. You also mentioned that you didn't like the Hammer matchup.
Yeah, this is one that I don't have much direct experience of, and from the other side, like, watching my teammate play against Hammer, it felt better for the Scam side than I had expected, but just the looming threat of Sanctifier on deck is always there, and I don't know how that contorts how you have to sideboard necessarily. Like, do you want more Thought Seizes than you otherwise would against a deck like Hammer? Like, maybe I could believe that. But if I expected more Hammer than I did this weekend, I expected a decent amount, but it really didn't show up and didn't perform well. But if that changes again, as it probably will, if Murktide remains on top still, then I would maybe want more cards dedicated to that matchup for sure.
That's okay. Sanctifier specifically as an issue is certainly fair. My experience playing against the non-Sanctifier games has been that generally Fury does a pretty good job, and, like, I don't, it really is just Sanctifier swinging the individual games so much that it changes the actual matchup.
I think some of it is just Urza Saga is good against all of the relevant stuff in your deck that isn't Blood Moon, and yeah, Blood Moon is good against them, but you will just lose a decent amount of games to Saga, and there's not a ton you can do about that other than just play more Blood Moons, I suppose.
Well, I've kind of gotten into the mindset that, like, you don't need the full Scam. Like, just a Fury and a Blood Moon is enough to carry a lot of games. So, like, I'm okay being the Blood Moon deck against them.
Okay. I am encouraged to believe that, because then that's another matchup that doesn't need any more kind of radical approaches taken to it.
It may be a timing thing depending on how many Sanctifiers they decide to play on a given weekend.
Mm-hmm. I do think the mana base maybe is worth touching on quickly, because you don't have that many lands in the first place, and a lot of those are spoken for. You do see some debate over this 19th land. Like, do you want it to be another Manica Rebirth? I know some lists have an Agadeem's Awakening just as an untapped black source, albeit a painful one, that you can pitch to a Grief, or Pyromancer, I suppose. And then some lists have a Castle Lockthrain for matchups like the Mirror. I went with the Takanuma just because it seemed to me like having that source be untapped was important, and, you know, having a draw that's like Blackleaf Cliffs, Castle Lochthwain, and now I just can't sequence my spells properly. That seemed like a disaster waiting to happen. And the Sakonuma, it's effectively a swamp when you want it to be, and then also in the longer games, it can buy you back that Fury or that Grief or something to depress that advantage.
Did you ever use the Takanuma? Because I know I'm running into this issue in Standard where, like, there's a Takanuma in the Crixus list and it's just a swamp.
Yeah, I think I did once or twice, but I could see it just being like a Graven Cairns or something instead, which looks very awkward in those one land hands where, like, yeah, it's not casting your Aggravant or your Thoughtseize or whatever, but there are definitely times where I had to fetch basic swamps to cast Voidwalker and then couldn't really bridge effectively two Seasoned Pyromancer or the reverse, right? Like, I cast Ragavan, but then I don't really want to Fetch Rock in a Blood Crypt, so being able to just painlessly transition into Voidwalker instead would have been nice.
Yeah, that's fair. I am much more concerned about the games where, like, you just have Graven Cairns and Feign Death, and you're just like, well, that's not how that works.
Yes, I mean, that also is a problem. That is a problem. Yeah, maybe like an Urborg or something is actually the best use for that in mind.
That's totally fair. I'm trying to remember if the last list of this that I had played had Urborgs in it. You are right, as long as it's like a reasonable untapped Black Source. Actually, I think I may have just had another basic swamp because that was a 3 Blood Moon era.
Yeah, I think it would also not be outrageous to just have an additional land in the sideboard for the matchups where you're bringing in all of these additional 3 drops. I don't think that's outrageous at all. And at that point, maybe that land wants to be the castle or something because you're less pressured by speed and you're just looking to win a longer game. So maybe like one sideboard Castle Lochthwain actually is justifiable.
Oh gosh, I can barely get behind Castle Lochthwain in the Pioneer Rakdos deck, let alone one that has like real format mana requirements and not like, I don't know, whatever's going on with the Pioneer decks that just kind of like do stuff and things happen. I just like, there's so many one drops in this deck that if you ever miss with Castle, it's so bad.
Yeah, but I think that is an underused deck building tactic in general, is a sideboard land to adjust that count for particular matchups, and then having that land priced into what you're trying to do with it. So if it is to let you hit all your land drops in a control mirror, well, you want that additional land to be a land which has some utility in a control mirror. So maybe more Pioneer control decks just have a sideboard Castle Vantress or something. Like that doesn't seem absurd to me.
That's fair. The problem is that, like, if you were most of the Castle Vantress decks are decks that already start the number of lands that they would want in a mirror because their deck just has to function that way. There's very few decks where you are like excited, like are in the position to Castle Vantress someone and like also start, like, I don't know, I would not be like the decks that are under that. Maybe you could talk about like the Crackling Drake deck doing that, but like it's this very limited section of decks that is like a land light mid-range deck that is trying to go long but also not necessarily be hyper efficient. It's a lot of things to line up. Like this deck, Rakdos Scam, is one of those decks that actually presents that, but I don't know how many other decks do. And again, like, you maybe could say Rakdos in Pioneer does that, but at the same time, like, I don't know, just play the extra land because your deck loses if it doesn't hit your third land against everything.
Yeah, that is part of why I kind of like the idea of the second Manica Rebirth, is that in the matchups where you want to have a higher virtual land count, you get to do that, but also you can shave down on the Feign Death effect and still have access to that angle, even if it's minimized somewhat.
That's maybe, yeah, I could see maybe boarding in. No, it's just the graveyard hate angle. I was like, yeah, Malakir Rebirth. Nah, I don't think that. And we're not like, I'm not going down to the world of like boarding in a Hogra Mauling. That's just not tenable.
Anyway, I'm not talking about castles in various formats, but we'll get back to the matchups here. So we covered Hammer, we covered Murktide. We should touch on the mirror, but do you have any more cohesive thoughts on how to approach that than I do?
I don't, honestly. It is even more of a mess than the Murktide mirror, which is like all the Ragavan mirrors are sort of a mess because like Ragavan matters so much, but the higher scale stuff matters so much. It's just this mirror so much, like everything is compacted in time too. So there's not even like phases. There's just like things happen immediately.
Yeah, so maybe Leyline is the kind of the best of a bad bunch in terms of the options there. And that might be enough, honestly, to justify playing a few Leylines. And I think this is one thing that people do a lot when looking at sideboards is they'll see, well, you have some unlicensed hearses and you have some Leylines. And they say, well, you already have four main deck Voidwalkers and there aren't that many dedicated graveyard decks. Sure, this seems like a lot of graveyard hate. Surely you can cut away at some of that and make room for cards for other matchups. But in reality, those graveyard hate cards are not perfectly overlapping in terms of where you want them. And hey, if you happen to get paired against Living End, well, yeah, you'll gladly board in every piece you can get and be very happy about it. But for the most part, those have different purposes in mind. And so you shouldn't just lump them under the same banner of, yeah, these cards are anti-graveyard and I want exactly N of these. Why do you have more than that?
Yeah, I think the Living End comment is worth touching on because that deck has seen a slight resurgence. And the key, I have actually... The game, you win the match a lot, but the games are always closer than they seem because how important it is to layer hate cards, which is one of the reasons why, like, all these Blood Moons is also great because they can maybe beat, like, a Dothi Voidwalker. What they can't beat is, like, the Dothi Voidwalker and the Blood Moon or, like, the Voidwalker and the Leyline. It's really the and that gets them with a lot of decks, but also, like, really this one because... You are not the fast, like, you aren't going to kill them faster than they're going to combo off, but, like, you are pretty good at killing them before they can deal with two things.
Yeah, you feel like you're ahead, but you need to think carefully about how they can get themselves out of that lattice of hate cards. So I had a game against Living End in the challenge the day before the Mana Traders where I played a Dothi Voidwalker, and I think they... either cycle twice or they like Waker of Waves into another big thing in response. And I realized that if they just untap and Living End from this point, then they actually just beat me on the board and there's not much I can do about it. So once the Voidwalker resolved, I had to then evoke Fury, killing my own Dothi Voidwalker, because once it was in the graveyard, I could do the trick of like re-Living Ending them with my Voidwalker while it was there. And then the Fury would buy me enough time to like survive the turn that would let me do that.
Yeah, the Dothi Voidwalker in the graveyard thing is like an important thing to bring up where like there is a window where you are trying to specifically on the draw, like your Dothi Voidwalker can be on the battlefield and they could have already cycled turn one, double cycled turn two, and then just untap and Living End. The key is that once Dothi Voidwalker is active, it just hangs out and you get to activate it in response to a Living End and flip everything back. By casting the Dothi from the graveyard, like, yeah, that whole thing.
Yeah, and so in that matchup in particular, a lot of the time you're thinking, how do I pad the rest of my board in order to buy me the turn to make that possible? So sometimes you'll like play a Ragavan and legend draw your own Ragavan just to have the Ragavan that you legend drawed away come back as a blocker that you can throw in front of a Wake of Waves or a Strife River Rinder or something like that. Or, you know, you'll just... Evoke Fury, no Feign Death, no nothing. Just Evoke Fury to get it in your graveyard because that's where it belongs. Or, you know, you'll be Seasoned Pyromancing away your own creatures and then trying to kill your own Seasoned Pyromancer with a Fatal Push or something. Like, you go through these weird hoops to break the symmetry of Living End so that you can then really break the symmetry of Living End.
Yeah, just to be clear there, you're referring to that one turn being the, like, if they end a turn Violent Outburst and untap, they have a turn of attack.
Yes, yeah, the Shardless Agent thing, just having Voidwalker in the graveyard tends to lock that out by default, but then, as is often the case against the Cascade decks, you're always thinking, what if they have Violent Outburst? Does them passing the turn without doing anything suggest that they have Violent Outburst, or are there other reasons they might be doing that? And that just shapes the entire dynamic of the game most of the time.
Okay, so we talked about Living End, what about Footfalls?
So I was 3-0 against Footfalls in the tournament. It felt like a solid matchup. I think you're ahead, but the games are close. And then there were always these turn-by-turn micro decisions of, you know, do I just attack with everything? Because if they have Footfalls or if they have a Violent Outburst, I kind of get blown out. But if I don't attack, then I'm giving them like another turn or two to find a Cascade spell to stay in the game. They have a lot of removal, so, you know, Ragavan doesn't dominate them as much as you would like, or Voidwalker or whatever, but if they can't kill Voidwalker, then you get into these weird Footfalls mirrors where they Footfalls and then you just use Voidwalker on their own Footfalls. Now you both have Rhinos staring at each other, or a lot of the time both of you have four copies of Fury, and so the game just comes down to who can sick the last Fury, and positioning yourself to do that. Sometimes the decisions with Thoughtseize or Grief can be interesting too, because you often have this default heuristic of, I'll just take their Cascade spell and that's fine. But then you also have the games where they suspend for Force on one, and then the rest of their hand is just four pretty good interactive cards, and you have to figure out how to thread the needle so that I can beat the ones that I leave them with and the runners that I know are coming, and then whatever might emerge from the top of the deck in the next few turns or so.
Yeah, those situations are often resolved by just casting Fury, has been my experience, where like your Fury equals their entire footfalls, and then you get back to parity from there.
Yeah, you also have weird games sometimes against Brazen Borrower where, okay, yeah, if you Petty Theft my Fury, I now have another virtual copy of Fury left in the tank, but it's one that maybe has no permanent upside, and then the actual 3-1 Flash Flyer can be surprisingly annoying to deal with, and you have to make sure that, and this comes up in games against like Endurance as well, that you don't let yourself get to a low enough life total that timely Flash Threat into timely removal spell actually puts you behind in a way that could have been avoided.
Has the Become Immense ever come up against you, or like, is that that's really threatening? Okay.
It has, and that is, I think, why it's such a good card in the Footfall deck, is it creates these board states where they get to make these attacks or these blocks where no other card could do anything, but the threat of Become Immense warps the entire combat set around it.
Okay, so I guess going down the list, Yawgmoth, I don't think there's a lot to talk about. That matchup's kind of free.
So I watched the streamed, I'm not going to call it a grudge match, it seemed like there was a friendly vibe, but the Demonic Tutors versus Young Dingo exhibition match from a while back, I guess I would call it, and they made it look closer than the consensus would have you think, but most Yawgmoth players are not Demonic Tutors, and I guess also most Scam players are not Young Dingo, but I do think that matchup is, you know, solidly positive for Scam, but I don't know if there's much interesting to say about it. And that's going down the line here, so many possible matchups in Modern, I feel like a lot of those, the script kind of writes itself past a certain point, and we've covered most of the ones where there's more nuance to it. Like against Amulet, for example, yeah, you Blood Moon them, all of your disruption is good, they will take their beatings, congratulations on getting paired against this matchup. Not sure what else there is to say, really.
Yeah, I think that the only ones that I kind of want to highlight are Mill and Burn, just because one of the other unique aspects of this deck that is not highlighted enough is that you have big mana costs in your deck that actually come up in those matchups, even though, like, the average, like, these threes, fours, and fives are bringing up your cost against Tasha's. But also, I've won my fair share of Burn matchups just, like, I don't know, they play a late Eidolon and just die to a grief or whatever. Like, you just cast it.
Yeah, it did strike me. I got paired against Eldrazi Tron in round one of Mana Traders. And looking down the deck list, I realized I am drawing Dead to Ensnaring Bridge if there's, you know, unless some very weird series of events happens. And so less of a concern against that kind of Tron deck, where it's only via getting to Tron and then having come the Great Creator. But against a deck like Prison Tron, for example, I could see that deck actually being a pretty solid response to if, you know, Scam plus Murktide continues to be a pretty big portion of any given Modern tournament. Maybe just some Ensnaring Bridge deck is a good counter to that.
Maybe that would be the reason to move back to some number of Kolaghan's Commands. But yeah, like you're saying, like if the point is like, yeah, I'm just trying to beat this deck with Blood Moon, they'll just tap three lands and play Ensnaring Bridge.
Yeah, Kolaghan's Command is a card which you often see as a one-off in some Scam lists, and I think it's fine. It's got a good colors, if you like, and it gets back both of the elementals that could pitch it as well. So it coheres nicely with the overall game plan, gives you some outs to cards like Ensnaring Bridge, or you don't really care about Chalice of the Void, but if you do care for some reason, you can tag that too. Just Amulet of Vigor, Colossus Hammer, good coverage against stuff. But yeah, once you already have Pyromancer and some Fables and some Blood Moons, it's just hard to find room for yet another 3-drop, which isn't strictly necessary.
Yeah, the only spot that I was not a huge fan of that card was a grindy card. I really liked it against Hammer, and that was about it.
Yeah,
it's obviously great there. Yeah.
Yeah, if you expect more Hammer, good card to turn to, but doesn't really solve the Sanctifier problem, which is the big problem kind of looming over the proceedings there.
Yeah, that is fair. If your concern is Sanctifier, that card has no interaction there. Yeah, I think that about covers the matchups and the spread for Scam. Are you ready to dive into the rest of the Modern metagame? Because there's some stuff going on beyond Scam.
Yeah, I guess one family of matchups which are worth considering more after this weekend are the various Omnath decks, which in aggregate were actually the second most popular archetype, if I remember rightly, from the Mana Phases event. Had a good weekend of challenges overall, and I know there are a lot of people who have been down bad since the Yorion ban, looking for any excuse to sleep up their Omnaths again, and so I think they will be jumping on that. So that's something you will have to care about looking into future weeks. But the fact that there's no clear consensus on what these builds should look like, how many cards between the numbers 60 and 80 these builds should have, lots of unanswered questions there, which makes it tough to know exactly which angle to target against them.
I will say that even if Elish Norn is good once it resolves, resolving a 5-mana permanent that actually costs 5 against Scam, not the best plan.
No, that is much easier said than done. Worth noting they can do that. You know, if they're able to fetch a basic planes before your Blood Moon effect comes down, then this is a threat that can be cast on the Blood Moon, which is a little scary sometimes. But yeah, I guess your basic formula is pretty good there. Like, all your stuff does things, and then you can lit up on more Blood Moon effects. I don't know if there is a nuclear option, if those decks are popular. And I think this is, you know, to go back to the history we gave at the start, this was one thing that kept both Murktide and Scam down for a while, is just the four-color Yorion decks, which I think were good against Murktide, good against Scam as well. And once they lost Yorion, they lost most of their raison d'etre, but also they lost the central thing which let them just automatically win the grindy games against those decks. And without that, you can actually fight them on that axis now.
Yeah, I will just say one thing about that matchup, where resolving a Blood Moon doesn't always cut them off all their spells, but it is really easy to win the games where they're only casting a fraction of their spells or not being able to do two things in one turn.
Yeah, a lot of these builds now do have abundant growth even without the Yorion tie-in, and so that is an issue, and that makes that entire approach less effective. And that's why I'm thinking, what is the next best thing to turn to? So previously, a lot of Scamlists had these Tauraks in the sideboard, and those are good against decks like 4-color. I didn't actually expect much of those in this tournament, and maybe that was my bad, and so I cut the Tauraks. Maybe those are the things you have to revisit if you expect 4-color to be a big player again.
Scam did win one of the challenges this weekend, and I believe there were a couple Tauraks in the sideboard at that list. Not a direct parallel, but I don't really see a reason for that unless you expect a lot of the Omnath decks.
Mm-hmm. And if you do, I think, I mean, is Tauruk the best option, or would you have something else in mind?
Yeah, it's pretty straightforward. Like, it's just so many cards and, like, such a real threat. I think Tauruk is the immediate thing I would move to in those matchups, even if, like, Veil of Summer, like, whatever. You have too many cards that card's good against to really care.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, with that, I guess the only other thing to touch on would be any weird Douthi Voidwalker timing or rules trickery or anything with that card that we haven't covered yet?
I guess one thing I would highlight is that, like, there can be, like, when you Feign Death a Douthi Voidwalker, there's, like, weird gaps in the coverage of it, if that's a slight concern for you. I don't know. It is just, like, a very weird card to make decisions with, is my general takeaway. Maybe the weirder thing than, like, the card itself may actually be that one of the things in the creativity matchup is that if you have an early Douthi Voidwalker, it may be worth saving a grief with the hope of just sort of spiking their Archon. I don't know how often that's the best play to make, where you just, like, Voidwalker on two and then grief them, but, like, that could be a line you plan for.
Yeah, it's something which, if you have the chance to do it, you obviously jump at that chance. More often, you Voidwalker them, you grief them, you take their Fable or their Creativity or something, and you have no intention to catch your Voidwalker in for that, but you get that out of the way, and that's something you don't have to deal with. But that idea of you're against some deck that is building towards one specific play, and you get to leverage that against them with Voidwalker, like against Amulet, I have had my fair share of my own Primeval Titans cast against me on turn three or what have you. And then, yeah, I think that is a play to be on the lookout for. Can come up against the other decks that have their own incarnation. So against 4-color, right, sometimes you will snag their Omnath or snag a, let's say, a Solitude or a Fury that is stranded without the right color to pitch immediately, and then you get to turn that against them, or you take their own Elish Norn perhaps. So I guess be on the lookout for stuff like that, but usually those plays are staring you in the face and, like, loudly tempting you to do those. So I don't think that those need much elaboration. in terms of specific card interactions, be aware that damage-based removal, like Unholy Heat, for example, because that damage kills it when state-based effects are checked after the card resolves, if you Unholy Heat a Delphi Voidwalker, the heat will go into exile with a void counter on it in a way that if you prismatic ending it, the prismatic ending would not. So something to be on the lookout for there. Dress Down is an odd one where if you are, you know, usually you attack with your Voidwalker and it's free because it, well, it can't block and they can't block it because it has shadow. Dress Down removing shadow changes that whole equation around. So don't just like get your Voidwalker eaten in combat there for no reason. And also be aware that if they are forced to use a Dress Down on their own turn for whatever reason, then your Voidwalker now might be a relevant blocker in a way that it wasn't before. So I think those are some of the obvious ones to look out for. I'm trying to think of any others. Is there some weird double up effect where if you have Voidwalker and Leyline in the Void, you choose which replacement effect applies, or do they?
Like, how they choose because they are the player who controls the or owns the affected card.
Okay, so yes, be aware that if you have Leyline and Voidwalker and something of theirs would go to the graveyard, they choose which non-graveyard exile effect is going to apply to it, and so that will not get trapped under the Voidwalker. So be on the lookout for that. Any other stuff that you can think of from the top of your head?
No, not off the top of my head. Dothy Voidwalker, just like a strange one. Just keep an eye out for like random things that pop up over the course of a game with it, because like it's sort of like Raghavan, but like when you have Raghavan and you're casting your opponent's spells, you are usually so far ahead it doesn't matter. When you have Dothy Voidwalker and you're doing it, it can be a real about face.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, let's get into the various non-scam related topics from the weekend. I think that covers everything. So Scam itself had a good weekend, both in Mana Traders and in the various challenges from the weekend. What else from those stood out to you?
Well, there, you know, we mentioned Living End a lot more this week than we have for probably months, because it's resurfacing and putting up probably... It's closer to parity with Rhinos. Like, it actually is. I think that's the important point. Don't expect a lot of it, but expect some of it. It's not a like going to change your reasons to do anything, but I think it did finish in the finals of one of the challenges this weekend. The big shock may just be that the Mono White Humans deck is just winning a lot. It had two top eights this weekend and another top 16. Just, like, a lot of winning.
How much of that is Hank the Obese just standing on everyone and enjoying their day in the sun versus other people coming to the same conclusions and actually partaking in that themselves as well?
Well, it is all them, but I think the deck is legitimately good. There are matchups that are basically unwinnable. Like, I do not think that the way the deck is structured now, the hammer matchup is remotely functional. Like, that, I think that should be sort of obvious, like, looking at the deck and, like, the original list, it's especially egregious. If you look at the original list, there's like two Lorans and nothing else that really stops the hammer deck, and that's just not going to work. But there's a lot of just like fundamentally good things about this deck, like, you know, loading up on Sanctifier, like the hate pieces in the sideboard are good. I was a big fan of the Brenton Forgender. That card is just great. Two Thalia, just like what you should be doing. Like, the problem with Thalia for years has actually just been drawing two of them is very bad. But, like, drawing one is fine, and playing two is the right number to play. And Adeline, oh my gosh, that card is so good. I think that the thing that is easy to miss in Modern with the card is how often the card has, like, three power of haste when it ETBs. It's not just the normal, like, oh, it made a token. It's like, oh no, there's a counter over here and a counter over here. And, like, there's the token, and, like, it's just so much stuff. Like, I don't know, just, like, a really good standalone card that wins a lot of games that humans often previously lost. I think, like, that card and Aspirant, like, really leveling up the games that, like, you get attrition down. Like, yes, your champions and your Thalia's Lieutenants can be bad if you are getting chipped away at, but, like, you have cards to draw that are actually good there. And I think the last piece that might be tying this all together is, like, I don't know, when's the last time you saw Ren in Success out of Creativity?
Yeah, that card really is falling off a bit. Although I guess the literal answer to that question is all the matchups I played against the various four color decks over the past week, where maybe that is the card kind of cresting the wave and coming back again. So now that this deck is a known quantity, where do you think there's room to iterate on it from here? Because it's doing this weird thing with very weird specific angles. What room is there for improvement in your view?
I mean, I think there's just generally a lot of, like, the two Thalias and Rafine performance, like, I don't think those are set in stone. I think there's just, like, a lot of room to play, like, choose a hate bear, play it in your deck. It's not that complicated. Like, I don't even think the namesake Shining Shoal as a 4 of is a requirement. It just is very good when you expect to play against a lot of red decks and have the, like, just, like, the generic interaction with Shining Shoal that's the best is, like, they play Raghavan, you play any one drop, and they're just like, welp, we're going to trade, because if I try and Lightning Bolt your thing and get Shining Shoal, the game ends. Like, I think there's just a lot of room to move around some of the more conditional slots and just, like, main deck. You expect to play against a bunch of Crashing Footballs decks, so your Drawneth Magistrates are just in your main deck.
Yeah, it seems like if you view it as this hybrid of random weird aggro deck and then Death and Taxes, Hate Bear Extravaganza, some medium in between there on that spectrum, you can kind of adjust that to whatever you expect to face against.
Yeah, I would also sort of cite the deck as like, you have a lot. So like the problem with humans is that the power level of modern sort of crunched down such that it was no longer actually above par. But when you account for like free spells and Chancellor of the Annex as pseudo wastelands, almost where like you are putting yourself ahead of your opponent in development, that is like one of the big things that this deck improves at. So I'm aware that I highlighted the hate bears as places this deck can change, but I don't think that is the actual fundamental draw of the deck. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just like taking more game actions when humans just like the goal of the deck is just like take more game actions and build a bigger board. And that affords you the time to do it by just playing free spells.
Could we talk about this Sunday challenge?
Okay, let's get started.
Okay, so in first place, he's back, baby. It's Prison Mike himself. Sasura's MTG on... is it fair to say his trademark deck at this point? Because we've moved past the Prison Mike days, and now we're on, Goyo's Vengeance targeting Emrakul Mike?
Yeah, I mean, this is basically a transition to Nonsense of the Week, where, like, we just can highlight a bunch of different absolute nonsense Urza Saga decks that won or top-8ed challenges this week. This is just the first one, right? Like, Profane Tutor, a... just happening normal in modern, like that's just what's going on.
Yeah, I think that card, I played against a Felix Liu special in a prelim where he was using Profane Tutor to, as a card that worked with As Foretold and Fires of Invention, but also to set up whatever other conditional zero drop plays worked along with those. So there was like one Restore Balance in the deck, one Wheel of Fate to pair with his Narset and so on. Like, there was a lot going on, and I was here for every second of it, but I think that if the format gets to a point where combo decks kind of in that space have time to breathe with Profane Tutor, it is actually a very good card at just setting all of that stuff up.
Yeah, I think the other thing here is that, you know, I said, how many times have you seen a Ren and Six recently? How many times have you seen a Teferi recently? That used to be the reason you could not play Profane Tutor, was just like your opponent would have Teferi in their Yorion deck and the game would end. That's just like not happening.
A lot of that is the overlap, right? Right now, the answer to those two questions is, well, it's the same deck. It's just the four color Omnath decks. But it remains to be seen how popular those will be. And then the other homes for Teferi, like Blue Eye Control, not really seen much around at all. And then the Breach decks, which used to have Teferi, whether Fair Breach or Unfair Breach, those have kind of receded into the background too. So yeah, you're only really seeing Teferi in that one specific shell. And at that point, yeah, the limit on cascading stuff, whether it's, you know, Living End over here or Profane Tutor as well, that cap is lifted. Going back to one theme we had a long time ago at this point, we had a whole episode dedicated to two questions, or two episodes on each of these. So firstly, what happened to black in modern? Why is black suffering so much? And then the second one is, what happened to combo in modern? Why is combo suffering so much? And I guess this deck by Prison Mike is the answer that we didn't know we needed to both of those questions. But maybe the core conceit of the main segment in this episode, like maybe Scam is kind of the answer to both of those questions too. This is how you do the black disruptive thing right, and this is how you do the weird linear thing right as well.
Yeah, I'm just noticing, looking at this, that when we previously talked about this deck, I want to say in a a Nonsense of the Week about a month and a half ago, a month or so ago, there was one Gristlebrand, and now there's just four Atraxa.
Yeah, and the thing is, I don't actually know if Atraxa is better in this context. I think that people got in this mindset of Atraxa is the new Gristlebrand, this is the new best thing to cheat into play in every single format under the sun, and I think that you're starting to see a little bit of pushback on that now. So in Legacy, for example, you saw reanimated decks in the first week that were four Atraxa, all in on Atraxa, let's go. And that made sense if you cared about it being a blue card to pitch a forcible and stuff like that. But in the more conventional, just mostly black with a dash of red reanimated decks, those decks now still on four Gristlebrand because there are definitely default scenarios, but that's just the better thing to have instead. And looking at this deck, I kind of think this might be the same way. I don't know.
I don't know. I'm in the Atraxa camp. Like, just the jump from one Gristlebrand to four Atraxa feels like it speaks volumes here. Like, it is just a good, it is an always good thing to just fire off.
Yeah, that is fair enough. And you can fire it off even in the face of, you know, a face out Solitude or something like that and still get your money's worth. And if your life total is under pressure, then you still get cards worth of value out of Atraxa, and then maybe you can parlay that into something else. So I guess I could see that, but maybe there is meant to be some kind of split here. Maybe you start with four Emrakul, and then the secondary target, actually, there is some competition for that slot now.
That is fair, but you don't, I guess, I don't know how often you're going to be like, if you could Profane Tutor for an Atraxa and like set it up, or like a Gristlebrand and set it up when like you're debating about that, why not just get an Emrakul?
I guess the answer there would be like specifically Solitude or stuff where, you know, there's a lot of cards which happen to blunt an entire Emrakul attempt, which if you go for Atraxa, you go for Gristlebrand, you get a lot back out of that. But I don't know. Either way, that is not the focal point here. The focal point is Prism Nike won a challenge with a really cool deck, and I hope this thing sticks around. I fear it's just going to be Prism Nike in another challenge in like 2 months in the top 16 or something, but I really hope that more people pick up this ball and run with it.
I will definitely have to give it a try. On the list of repeat decks top eighting, you know, you mentioned the Boros deck that is Obosh and Timeless Dragon top eighting again. I have not had time to play with that deck. I understand that you like some of the core conceits. I still don't get it.
Yeah, I like it. There is probably some more work to be done, but I think just philosophically, it's in the same vein as these various M. Hayashi red decks or the various like Raghavan into Blood Moon plus Mages of the Moon decks. That shell in all of its guises, I mean, it top eighted again in one of these challenges here, and I think is probably not going anywhere anytime soon. So I don't know. Decks like that, I think, are here to stay, even if it's not exactly like weird Boros, Obosh, Elishnorn deck.
That's totally fair. Okay, so we talked. Is it correct to say that of the Urza Saga decks that top eighted this weekend, the Goryeo's Vengeance deck is like the second most normal behind the like couple copies of Hammer? Like, it is a shockingly good weekend for Urza Saga, despite Hammer being like 30% of the Urza Saga metagame.
Yeah, I think there may be more non-conventional Saga decks than there have been in quite some time. And so, yeah, there's shockingly little Hammer, basically no Amulet compared to its peak a few weeks ago. And so the Urza Saga share of the metagame is all of this wacky stuff that just kind of came out of nowhere, but is heavily subsidized by Urza Saga. And so, yeah, again, going to this throwback, when we were discussing, like, is Urza Saga a good thing for the format? And do we think it's going to be stifling enough that action has to be taken at some point? I think our consensus at the time was it's a good thing and no, it seems fine. And I think that's been borne out by stuff like this, where you can get up to this weird and wacky stuff safe in the knowledge that Urza Saga is both a good enabler and just a fine plan B if it comes down to that.
Yeah, I think that the last time we had this discussion, we came to the conclusion that we didn't understand why people were not just playing Breach to some degree, and it was like maybe just no one can beat a Construct token. I don't know if that's the case, but I think let's just start talking about the decks that look like they are designed with the intent that no one can beat a Construct token. Let's start with the deck that has been labeled as Affinity from the top eight of the Saturday challenge, but it definitely is not Affinity. I don't think there's a single Affinity card in this deck.
Well, that's been a problem going on 20 years now, so I think we're kind of used to that naming convention.
Well, there's not even an artifact land.
No, there is a singular copy of Spreading Seas just hanging out here in the main deck for some reason.
Well, that's so you can discard it to Restoration of Igondro and bring it back for free.
Oh, wow. Oh, okay. I am into that. Tell me more.
Well, it might also just be overflow from the other three copies of Spreading Seas in the sideboard. This is, like... The creatures are Esper Sentinel, Thraben Inspector, Stoneforge Mystic, and Solitude. So there's Ephemerates in the deck. So it's Affinity Scam?
I guess. I don't know what a deck needs to do to qualify as Scam, but it is certainly gesturing in that general direction.
Yeah, there's also Power Conduit, a card that has shown up in the mono-red Ursa Saga decks, but here is, I guess, sort of like moving your counters from your Saga, but also like you have Restoration of Igondro as not actually Fable to move counters off of.
Yeah, so there's Restoration, Ursa Saga. You can eat just, yeah, eat counters off your own Teferi, and that starts with a decent amount of loyalty, so maybe that's fine as well. But yeah, weird to see that just there without too many like ancillary other synergies going on.
I also love that there's just like four Field of Rune. Like, it's very telling that this is like, it feels like you just like started with a Death and Taxes deck and then just started adding artifacts as opposed to anything else.
Yeah, I know that. So as more and more good non-basics get printed, and it feels very easy for even like two color decks to end up playing maybe two or three basics total, the idea of just, can I just spam Field of Ruin activations over and over, becomes this really tempting conceit in a lot of different formats. And I don't think we're quite there yet in Modern, but yeah, there are definitely like, you get paired against Tron or something, this is how your glacially slow mono-white Itch Affinity deck actually has a decent shot against Tron, potentially.
Yeah, I'm actually looking back, and this may be more related to the fact that this was a player who a year ago was top-8ing challenges with Crack the Earth.
Oh, God. Yeah, some people are just built different, I suppose.
Yeah, and they want to destroy lands, even if it's the Field of Rune way to do it. Yeah, another Sanctifier on Vec deck, another Lavinia deck. Oh, I forgot to mention this when I was talking about the Mono-White Humans deck. Another structural issue with the Hammer matchup is that, like, your opponent just plays Lavinia in their deck for other reasons, and then they play it against you, and you're just like, oh, all my interaction is uncastable, and the game ends. So that's a little bit of a problem.
Yeah, nice shining shore there, idiot. That is not even, by a long stretch, the most eye-catching, I suppose, Ursa Saga deck of this weekend.
Yeah, let's just, I want to preface this last deck with, I got in some last-minute research before this podcast was recorded. I actually got in three matches because I lost every game. I do not think this deck is good. I don't think it is functional, but it is here, and I want to talk about it.
Yes, I played against this deck in the Friday Challenge when I was testing Scam for the weekend, and once I realized what was happening to me, I welcomed it, I embraced it, I wanted it to happen. I wanted to lose to this, and I did, in fact, en route to the top 8 in the challenge. So this is the Goblin Engineer Graz Unstoppable Juggernaut Trash for Treasure deck.
Yeah, so Trash for Treasure, this card has been brought up in Nonsense of the Week a lot. It's just 2 in a red, sack an artifact, reanimate target artifact from your graveyard. Previously, I think the last thing it was doing was recurring Portal to Phyrexia, which is in this deck. There is a Portal to Phyrexia here. There's a Sundering Titan, but there's 3 Graz Unstoppable Juggernaut. And this is from Phyrexia All Will Be One, an 8-mana 7/5 that makes all your other creatures into Juggernauts. They attack each combat if able, can't be blocked by walls, and are 5/3s.
Yes, and so the idea here is you assemble a board full of your motley Vordaren Epicures and Seasoned Pyromancer tokens and so on, and then out of nowhere, some random artifact turns into Graz, and now suddenly you're attacking for, you know, 15 or 20, and if the game doesn't end, it's going to end within a turn or two.
Yeah, so I guess let's talk about some of the cool stuff, like Urza Saga becoming Juggernauts is good. I would advise you to think about what happens when your Juggernauts get +1/+1 for each artifact you control, even if other artifacts don't turn into Juggernauts. Scrapwork them up with everything is great. Like, One of the things that comes up is that you get to trash for treasure your Scrapbook Mutt into a Graz, and then next turn unearth it as a 5/3, which is surprisingly a different unearth card from the same set that costs a lot more to unearth.
Notably as well, if you get paired against Gabe Nassif and his Ban Arcades Wall of Omens deck or whatever, Graz really good against Wall of Omens.
Yes, I had not considered that. My problem is that, like, in any sort of contested low resource situation, Graz is not good. It doesn't really apply that. Like, these scenarios where you have all these creatures that turn into juggernauts, I feel like are few and far between, especially when you, like, sacrifice a permanent to get there. They're slow. I just, like, the card's vulnerable. I was not impressed. I feel like I would be more impressed if the deck was just all Sundering Titans and Portal Phyrexias, but I'm happy that Graz is here.
Yeah, do you think that Alternative Shell does have some promise then? Because I know we featured in a separate nonsense segment a mono-red-ish Asmo deck that was built with the same approach, basically. You had Trash of Treasure, Goblin Engineer, all of that good stuff. And then this is forsaking the Asmo cookbook stuff for a different approach instead. Is there something here with this core, or is the whole thing mostly just, oh, hey, it's cool that it's top 8ed, but I wouldn't put too much time on it?
Yeah, I think you could say core, but there's a lot wrong here. Like, I do not think this is an experimental synthesizer deck. You are just, like, too many of your cards don't cost one, so it's just too hard to cast. Especially when you, like, want it on the battlefield early to sacrifice, but, like, also don't want it. I think it's just terrible here. Same thing with Urza Saga, where, like, your Saga tokens are just small. I think that the Asmo decks, like, have the advantage of having Cookbook to make large Saga tokens. And in this deck, it's just very easy to not have, like, just, like, make a 1/1 Saga token, and that's not good.
Mm-hmm. So maybe the Asmo approach, if anything like this is going to work, it probably is that, you reckon?
Yeah, and that's a big if, I think. I think that there's a lot working against this deck. I think I need more reps with the actual Asmo deck, as much as you can call the, like, Scrapbook Mutt Asmo deck the actual one, like the Serenith Steelseeker list.
I think at this point the Asmo deck is whatever Sussurus one is challenged with this weekend. I think he decides what is stock now in the Asmo realm.
That's totally fair. Yeah, there may be some small pieces of this deck that are okay, but I just don't think it's quite on the power level that you're looking for right now.
Mm-hmm. So with that, I think that will do it for our nonsense of the week and for our entire episode. So you can find our articles respectively on SCG and CFB/GTG Player. My piece there this week is a guide to Rakdos Scam. So if you prefer this content delivered in a written medium, you can go check that out as a follow-up over there. You can find us on Twitter at Dom and Javier and at ARMLX. You can find the podcast on Twitter at @Dominaria_pod. You can find us on Patreon at patreon.com/Dominaria_judgment. You can find us and many other people singing the praises of the unstoppable Juggernaut over in the Discord. And we will hopefully find all of you back here at the same time next week. Take care, everyone.